We've worked our way through the recession, the property markets are moving on, and more Australians are looking at getting into property. So today I want to share three segments with you that will help you become a more successful investor. Firstly, I'm going to talk about six learning fees I don't want you to pay. These are costs that investors and home buyers have paid to the market or marketers or spruikers, and if you can avoid paying them, there'll be more money in your pocket. Secondly, I'm going to have a chat about some new urban trends with leading demographer Simon Kirstenmacher. Simon's a regular guest on this podcast and one of the most popular ones, and we're going to talk about how the coronavirus pandemic has forced all of us to reevaluate how we live and what that's going to mean to you for your own lifestyle, but also as a property investor or a business owner. And then lastly, in my mindset moment, I'm going to talk to you a bit about what I believe success is, and just as importantly, what success isn't. So welcome to today's episode of the Michael Yardney Podcast.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropole, who specialise in helping you grow, protect and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
You've heard me say it before. Property investing may be simple, but it's not easy. And it's not a play on words because many investors end up paying a huge learning fee, one that they didn't expect. You see, many novice investors think, or are often led to believe, that bricks and mortar is safe and it's an easy investment, but they find out the hard way, and often the expensive way, that property investment success isn't so easy. They pay a huge learning fee either to the market or sometimes to a property marketer or to a spruiker. So I'd like to have a look at six learning fees I've seen investors pay, because once you understand these, hopefully you won't have to. In other words, you'll have more money for your investments. The first learning fee I'd like to discuss with you is the "oops, I bought the wrong property" learning fee. You know, people buy a new home to live in, but in a short time, it just doesn't feel right. Or they buy an investment property and they realise it's a dud. Did you know that statistics show that 20% of people who buy an investment property sell up in the first 2 years and 50% sell up their investment property in the first 5 years? So if you decide to sell up in the first year or two, regardless of what price you sell the property for, remember there's all those costs of buying and selling. There's no way you can be ahead. There's the stamp duty that you paid for, the legal fees when you buy, when you sell, the selling agent's commission, the marketing costs. And of course, if it's your home, moving twice in quick succession is a real pain as well. That means your learning fee is likely to be tens of thousands of dollars, potentially even into six figures, when you take into account the lost opportunity cost. So the first learning mistake people make is, oops, I bought the wrong property. The second learning fee I've seen people make is the no capital growth learning fee. This is the fee you pay when you buy an investment with poor capital growth because it's either in the wrong city, the wrong suburb, or even in the wrong street. Perhaps it grows, I don't know, 2 or 3%, but when buying a property that could have maybe achieved 6 or 7% growth, look at the huge difference that the capital growth and the rental growth would be buying the right property. That small difference in the first year or two doesn't seem like much, but over the years, it adds up so that your learning fee easily goes into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. The third learning fee some people unfortunately learn is the renovation reality learning fee. This is the learning fee that you've got to pay when you realise that renovations are hard work. They're nowhere near as easy as on those reality TV shows or some of the property blogs would suggest. Perhaps you bought a property that needs significant renovation in order of, I don't know, 10% of the purchase price. But then when you add up all the other costs, things you didn't expect and the project ran over time, it increases your holding costs substantially. You could end up sinking up to 20% of the purchase price into your renovation, and all of a sudden you land in overcapitalized territory. This learning fee could easily cost you tens and tens of thousands of dollars, as well as the waiting period for many years as you wait for the market to improve enough to get your money back. The fourth learning fee I've seen people unfortunately pay is the I've got eaten by a shark learning fee. Here we have Sam and Susan, a couple of 25-year-olds, who charge off to one of those investment property seminars when they were able to be run in the old days. Today they're webinars that promise they'll make you $1 million in 6 months. Instead, our bright young things end up knee-deep in cash flow tables, bank documents, and signed investment contracts that result in them buying an off-the-plan, out-of-town, so-called whiz-bang property, growing at a miserable 1% or so per annum over the next 10 years. Boy, have I seen that happen over and over again. The learning fee in this scenario is especially scary, as that shark advice could end up being a millstone around their neck for many years. Because they bought a dud property, because they got eaten by a shark, because they got sucked in by a property spruiker or marketer, that takes them out of the market. It doesn't allow them to buy their next property. And the other thing is often they can't offload those properties without making a significant loss. Remember, a lot of investors buy their first property because they believe they're going to get depreciation allowance, good tax benefits, but that only comes with a new property. So if they try to sell their property in one of those new estates where all the houses look the same, or in one of those high-rise buildings where all the apartments look the same, but it's now an established property, investors are not going to pay anywhere near as much because they're not going to get the depreciation allowance, and owner-occupiers don't want to live there either. So the I got eaten by a shark learning fee keeps lots of people out of the market. In other words, they never get past their first investment property. But I've spoken to you about that before. Close to 90% of investors never get past their first or second property. 70-something percent of investors never get past their first property because they pay one of these learning fees. The fifth learning fee you better watch out for is the buying with emotion learning fee. You end up paying for this in two ways. First of all, when you fall in love with a property, you often overpay. Now, while that may be allowed if it's your home, it's a big mistake for property investors. But the second way you pay this fee is when you miss out on an opportunity because you've got unrealistic expectations of what a property price should actually be, an offer well below the acceptable market price. See, our markets have moved on. Well-located properties in the current market are not selling at bargains. There's a shortage of good properties and lots of people are moving into the market at the moment, owner-occupiers, first-home buyers and investors, knowing that the market's moved on. We've gotten through the pandemic, that we've gotten through the recession. But some people have got unrealistic expectations, especially when emotions get in the way. And then they get angry with the vendors. They think the vendors are being greedy. This learning fee is about your own ignorance and not remaining objective and basing your negotiations on cold hard facts, comparable sales, what's going on in the market. Either way, the learning fee of either paying too much because you fall in love or missing out because you're being a bit obstinate, it means you could end up paying considerably. The sixth learning fee that I've seen people pay to the market is the negotiation learning fee. This is the extra cost when you're too afraid or too inexperienced to negotiate on price. See, many property purchasers, whether they're home buyers or investors, are what I call shark bait to selling agents because they're highly trained negotiators. They've been taught how to get top dollar for their clients, the seller. All big estate agencies do a lot of training for their salespeople, and the difference between an average selling agent and a good selling agent is really their negotiating ability. So what should you do as a property investor or a home buyer? Many of us have been taught to learn from our mistakes, but in my opinion, it's too expensive. It's too demoralizing. Rather than paying a learning fee to the market, why not pay a property strategist to work with you, help you design your investment journey by creating a customized strategic property plan for you? Now, yes, I have a vested interest. My team at Metropole are property strategists and we help lots of property investors and home buyers. But we've seen the results they get. We've seen how many of our clients end up with 3, 4, 5, 6 properties when the average investor never gets past their first one. So I know it's much easier and cheaper and significantly reduces your learning fee to pay for advice rather than to make mistakes. However, to secure your financial future as their property markets move on, you're going to need more than just a buyer's agent, because buyer's agents are order takers now. Our team has got some great buyer's agents, but they only know their own patch. And I know some buyer's agents fly interstate and fly in and out. That doesn't give you the perspective that you require to make it work. You need more than the property strategist. You need a holistic approach to your wealth creation future. And that's what our team at Metropole do. We help you grow, protect, and pass on your assets to future generations. Why not have a look at what we do? Go to metropole.com.au. You'll find we customize the solution to meet your specific needs. If you're a beginning investor, it's obviously very different to if you're an experienced investor, or if you're a professional investor, we'll often help you get involved in property development. Why not make your investment journey safer? Let us provide direction. Let us help you with clarity in these changing times. Using our services really is a form of insurance against paying that kind of hefty learning fee that I've just outlined to you. In life, we all pay. The question is, how much? So go to metropole.com.au and find out what we do. The coronavirus pandemic has forced all Australians to reevaluate how we live our lives. Offices are shut, lockdowns are still in place in some areas, and people are now working from home more than ever. Gone are the days when home was simply a place we rest our head and enjoy some downtime between work and our social lives. The coronavirus social distancing has put an end to the life we once knew. So if social distancing and COVID environment has taught us anything, it's taught us the importance of neighbourhood. So in today's episode of the Michael Yardney podcast, I'm going to chat with Simon Kirstenmacher about some important urban trends that all property investors and all business people need to understand. Simon's Director of Research at the Demographics Group, a columnist in The Australian, and he's being globally recognised as a rising star in the field of data management and insights. And, of course, he's a regular guest on my podcast. Welcome, Simon.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, Simon, the world's a crazy place and COVID has changed it immeasurably. Now, some people say possibly forever. Like most huge societal and political shifts, some of these changes will inevitably be reflected in our property markets. Priorities are likely to change. Some buyers are willing to pay more for properties. I guess with what I'd like to call pandemic appeal, if you can leave your home and be in walking distance or a short trip to a great shopping center, your favorite coffee shop, amenities, maybe a beach, a park, these recently implemented coronavirus restrictions have shown us how important all this is. So, Simon, why is neighbourhood going to be so important moving forward?
Well, of course, where we live has always been important. The location, location, location credo didn't come from nowhere. But now that we live in a pandemic world with less international travel, with more people working from home, with us spending more time at home or near home, we're naturally seeking activities in walking distance, in the famous 20-minute radius around our house. And on top of all of these trends comes the natural demographic profile of Australia that we're in. We have a relative share of young people in the 20s and 30s that live in apartments and that spend time outside of the home, because apartments aren't meant to use for the socializing, to use for exercise. That big share of the population that is currently doing this is going to shift over the next 10 years as those young people actually move away from apartments, move away from the inner city, move to suburbia where the 3-4 bedroom homes are available. And then they will seek all the comforts that they had in walking distance in the inner city. They will seek this at their new suburban destinations as well. And so suburbia or the regional centers, wherever the young people move to get to the larger homes, they will need to adjust the neighborhoods. And this will be a large driver, not just for property development, but also for urban planning over the next decade or so.
Well, you brought up a couple of concepts that I'd like to explore as we chat. One is the 20-minute neighborhood. And the other one is the importance of what we'll call the third place, which is actually is a urban development term that's been coined by Ray Oldenburg, and refers to that place where people spend time between their first place, their home, and the second place, the workplace. And as you said, the homes today for a lot of us aren't designed to do a lot of entertaining. So that's where we go to the restaurants, the bars, the gyms, the houses of worship, even the barbershop, which I missed for a period of time. So you're right, neighbourhood, and that third place, we've realised how important it is. So the 20-minute neighbourhood's an urban planning concept. It's nothing new. And where you and I live, Melbourne, they've been talking about it for a while. Maybe you could explain a bit about what are the features of a 20-minute neighbourhood.
So the general idea with the 20-minute neighbourhood is that you take your home is at the centre of the 20-minute circle that you draw around your home. And the idea is that within this circle, this radius of 20 minutes, you have all the major functions of your life available. That really just means a short commute, a short walk or drive or bike trip to your local shop, barber, kindergarten, and all those things that you do. This, of course, also includes access to greenery, to outdoor space, to a public pool, for example. All of these things are encompassed by the concept of the 20-minute city, and it stands in contrast to a highly centralized city where you have all the functions in the city center, and then you essentially have dormitory suburbs far away from the city center that people need to commute in and out of to do all the functions of their life in the inner city. And it is a almost European concept, if you will, to have everything close by, simply because European cities were largely built up in a time before cars, where everything was within 20 minutes by default.
Yeah, when I learned about this concept a while ago, I recognised that's exactly what the European cities I've been lucky enough to visit have got. And many of Australia's capital city suburbs, the middle ring suburbs, the inner ring suburbs, already meet a 20-minute neighbourhood test. However, very few of the outer ones do. I think it's going to be harder for them because they need more density, but they also need more diversity, don't they, Simon?
And we do have the idea that lots of the outer suburbs that we developed over the last 10 years are essentially dormitory suburbs where there are not all the functions that you might want in your life are available. So you might have a local Coles or Woolies nearby. Maybe you have some sort of playground nearby, but that's about it. Have you enough libraries, pools, sporting clubs, all those things that you actually do want? Is your whole life contained in the 20 minutes? It doesn't mean that you're not leaving your 20-minute radius occasionally to go to the footy, to go to the museum or the ballet or whatever you do. But it means that overall, you have a localized city where you're very proud of your local neighborhood and you're quite familiar with the local nice cafes that you go to, with the local butcher, the local greengrocers. You have all those pieces in connection. And that's exactly what we've seen in the pandemic, that you grow quite close and comfortable with those local shops, that you put a higher emphasis on them being around. And I do think that this will actually carry through the pandemic.
Well, we've always said that location does a vast majority of the heavy lifting in the capital growth of properties because more people want to live in certain locations. And it's not just owner-occupiers, it's also tenants who are going to want to live in these areas. So I can see the trend's only going to grow more, the gap between those lifestyle locations, those 20-minute neighbourhoods, and the others, the outer ones, the gap's going to grow wider. But back to this third place concept, I think we've also recognised that people want a destination to go to where they feel part of. They've actually felt that they've missed out from this lately.
In recent years, people always complained about city living, that it is very anonymous, that you don't know your neighbors, that you don't know the local shopkeeper, simply because there are too many people churned around. But if you live in a 20-minute neighborhood, all the third places are actually very close to you. And after a while, if you only could get your takeaway coffee from the same couple of cafes over the last 7 months or so, people did know your name and you did get into a reasonably close conversation and contact with people. And it's a nice feeling. You do feel grounded in your local community.
So I know that I live in Brighton and I'm very lucky here. And sure, it's one of the more expensive suburbs in Melbourne, but it's within easy travel of the best strip shopping centres. There's gyms there, there's picture theatres, multi-screen picture theatres, not that we can go, the famous beach boxes. But it's a become a destination for a lot of people that potential owner occupiers, tenants want as well. And I think these sort of place locations, these destination locations, these aspirational locations are going to pick up. Think, I don't know, Collingwood, Fitzroy, Elwood in Melbourne, Bondi, Surry Hills, Darlinghurst in Sydney, Tenerife, New Farm in Brisbane, Braddon in ACT. People are going to want to be seen in those places too, aren't they, Simon?
Oh, these are the desirable locations. There are certain locations that carry a certain reputation with them that you want. And there will be plenty of surprise suburbs if you really take a close look at the data. We have all the luxuries that the famous examples that you just mentioned feature, but they're not as well known. So if you are a property picker, these will be the places that you go to. What are highly walkable neighborhoods that are not as expensive as of yet, for example, and that have the specific pandemic appeal, as you said, where you have large enough homes? Because if certain functions we will not have in third places, but we will draw back to the home. I'm thinking of simple stuff like, are people building garages that can be converted? Can my garage become my gym? That means, is my garage actually high enough that I can put a cross trainer in it, that I can do an overhead press with a barbell in my garage? All of those bizarre considerations that we didn't have on the radar a couple of months ago are all of a sudden probably adding to your property value.
Sure. So when people decide to move, if they need to move, they are going to look for different things, because this will be on our minds for some time yet, knowing that it could recur or other ones could. So are you really going to want to go into one of those buildings where you press the same lift buttons and share the same facilities as others? Most people are going to want to have a Zoom room. So while there will be room for one bedroom apartments, as soon as people partner up, Simon, I can imagine they're going to want an extra room. For having that home office, the work office, when they have their child, they're going to want an extra room again. We're upsizing a little bit, but we're going to still want to be in those good locations.
Absolutely. So the location consideration is front and center over the next 10 years. But of course, we do have lots of people that will consider one-bedroom apartments as ideal. Students, newly arrived migrants, skilled migrants, they will first settle in a small rental unit close to their job, and then over time learn how their city works, learn where the interesting suburbs are, and then move to larger homes. But the problem, of course, if you are invested in an inner city one-bedroom apartment at the moment, is that there will be fewer of them around in the next 10 years than there were in 2019. So that's a problem. But the main game in property will be the young families, will be the millennials seeking family-sized homes over the next 10 years. And, you know, those 3 and 4 bedroom houses, they are only available in the regions, in suburbia. And so those families, while they could theoretically live in a European-style 4 or 5 bedroom flat in the inner city, they won't do this in Australia because these dwellings are not available here. So you just move out.
There's also the talk that some people are going to move to regional areas to see change, tree change, or I don't know if anyone's called it coronavirus change yet, COVID change locations. But when you look at the various demographics, I'm not sure how much that'll happen. There's anecdotal evidence that is happening, Simon. There's evidence on property searches, but are people just searching, or are they actually going to move? Because for young people, it depends upon your the age group. The millennials, they're the ones who are more likely to be moving in their lifetime. But are they going to go where there aren't as many jobs, or there's not as likely to get a date in if you haven't got the right number of pubs or clubs around you?
That's right. So the move towards regional Australia, I do think will occur, but it's important to understand who will be moving. So if you are single, you are much better off actually in a large city, simply because there's a larger pool. And so people, young singles, will probably be hesitant to go to a regional set center, I would suggest. But the people that are most likely to go to a region, these are the young families where you already are partnered up, and particularly young families where the job might be a bit more mobile now, thanks to COVID, where we do actually can work from home at least 3 or 4 days per week. And maybe I'm willing to do an extreme commute for 1 or 2 days per week and move, of, you know, just commute from Bendigo into the CBD for 1 or 2 days. Bite the bullet. Do this really annoying commute. I do think there's a market for this, but it will be then a market for the larger sized homes. So I would expect that Bendigo will see growth, particularly in the 3-4 bedroom market rather than in the 1 or 2 bedroom market.
Sure, that makes sense. Having said that, those locations, the Bendigos and the Central Coasts, and the, well, maybe not as much the Gold Coast or the Sunshine Coast, they don't have as, it's not as big a market, and there's not as many established homes on the market, and that's going to hinder mobility if there aren't as many options.
Correct. And when we're talking about a regional population boom, we're not saying Bendigo will grow at the rate of 100,000 people that Melbourne was used to grow at. But we're talking about a significant uptick compared to 2019, which throws the markets in regional centers around a bit, simply because you need to add to the housing stock, and you need to add the right housing stock, because most likely you'll have inner city folks on reasonably high incomes coming who can actually afford the upper end of a regional market.
Oh, yes, there'll be some change left over if you do that as well. Having said that, I think at times of uncertainty, people become more resistant to change, less likely to move because there's still the certainty of where you are. And pandemics cause stress. And I guess one of the big stresses that's said to be as bad as a relationship breakup or divorce is moving house as well. So while it may actually seem like a good idea, it'll be interesting to see how many people actually go ahead with it.
And we are still operating with unknowns. We do know how the traditional Australian city works with the CBD, and we're now decentralizing a bit more with taking jobs out of the CBD, at least for part of the week, into the home. And we don't know at scale how this will work out. And there are different school of thoughts. There are people with lots of vested interest into getting people into the CBD or getting people out of the CBD. So this discussion is well alive in order to understand how this will play out. I do think that the CBD isn't dead at all. Like this discussion, every now and then you hear that the CBD will dry out. The CBDs of Australia have 3, maybe 4 really difficult years ahead, where we don't add enough young people, young students, young skilled migrants to the inner city. But once they come back, and according to the recent budget papers, they are supposed to come back in 2023 or thereabouts, then the CBDs will recover. So I can say this because I'm not building skyscrapers in the CBD. I'm not financially invested into the health of the CBD. But some people, of course, have their businesses bet on this.
Sure. So it's not just the accommodation there, but then what happens to the hairdressers and the cafes and the gyms and others in the CBD if there's not as many people as well? So I see it's still going back more to the suburbs. That's where we started. So the neighbourhood and your suburb is going to be very important. Walkability was always a big factor as well. You know, that all suburbs have now got a walk score, and all locations within suburbs have. I can see having a high walk score, having access to many things, is also going to be high on the list of people's requirements moving forward.
I'm actually certain that more and more people will look at these type of maps, those walk score maps, before buying a home, simply because you want to make sure that your house is livable of sorts. And a walk score is a reasonably good proxy data set in order to understand how livable your neighborhood is.
Sure. But again, with neighborhood, we talked about schools, we talked about others moving to regional Australia, you won't have as much of a choice of schools when you're talking about the school age people that you were talking about. And I think if you're again talking about who may or may not move to regional Australia, I can't see older people as much. They're still going to want to be close to where their children are, their grandchildren are, and they're not being as affected by COVID either. So the ones who've been most affected tend to, as we've discussed in previous chats, been the younger ones, the millennials, and in general also they've been the tenants. So maybe there won't be as big a move of owner-occupiers, but it'll be interesting to see the trend that's moving forward.
Yet I would not expect too many owner-occupiers being too keen to sell at the moment. If you just come out of a couple of boom years and you will now have, a bit of a lower market for a couple of years and you can hold off with your sale, I think many people will choose to hold. It's of course, everybody is betting whether the area might decline permanently and then it's better to sell sooner rather than later. But I think overall, particularly older people that are not needing the money right now will actually stay put where they are and then let the market recover and in the mid to late 20s potentially sell. But we do know that baby boomers, who are, of course, to a large degree empty nesters at the moment, occupying houses in middle Australia, in the middle suburbs, that they are not downsizing at scale. That baby boomers tend to downsize once the home becomes a physical hazard, once it becomes just impractical to live in the house, then they downshift. But baby boomers are still too young, too healthy, too fit, too full of life to actually consider downshifting just yet. So the baby boomer downshifting movement, that will occur in the 2030s. It won't occur in the next decade.
So in summary, neighbourhood's always been important, but it's probably going to be more important moving forward. The idea of a 20-minute neighbourhood is exciting for many people. The concept of a place, having a third place where you can enjoy yourself outside your home, where you feel part of the community, is going to be more important as well. And this will be one of the trends, or a couple of the trends, that are going to affect our property markets. And I guess also for business people, because if you're going to open up a business, Simon, you'd rather be where all these people are going to be.
That's correct. And if you think about it, for every coffee that is not being consumed in the CBD, in the city center, quite likely there is a coffee going to be consumed in the outer suburbs, or at the very least, people will buy a bit of a bag of coffee beans at their local Coles or deli.
Well, it'll be interesting as we keep having our chats to see how these trends work out. Thank you so much for your time today, Simon.
Oh, my pleasure.
Now here's Michael's mindset message. Remember, a change in your thinking will lead to a change in your life.
Today, in our mindset message, I'd like to discuss with you what success looks like. Now, it's fair to say we're living in interesting times, isn't it? And if you're following people on social media, you're seeing them making success, creating success, launching lucrative careers through YouTube, video platforms, Instagram. They're getting thousands of social media followers, aren't they? Now, good luck to those who are doing it. And of course, some of them in these celebrity driven eras lose sight of what success really means. You see, instant success is easier to achieve than long-lasting success. And the last thing you want is a flash-in-the-pan success story. So in the teachings I give, in my podcasts, in my blogs, in my videos, in my books, I want people to learn the fundamentals of achieving success based on a long-term vision. Now, success that doesn't last isn't really success anyway, is it? So I thought I'd just take a moment to discuss with you what success looks like. Let's start off with what success is not. Success isn't about showing off. While financial freedom is a big part of success, the truly well-off, they don't flaunt it. I know people will show you on the Instagram their fancy cars and their beautiful clothes, but having a lot of money is a reflection of how hard you've worked and you should be proud of it. But using it to show off with displays of wealth, in my mind, that's tacky. Success isn't about buying more things, because once you start to achieve financial freedom, it's tempting to go and buy more things. But my advice is always to be very careful about what you spend your money on. Pick a few luxuries that you're going to enjoy. Spend your money on those. And then save the rest. Invest the rest. Of course, success isn't about keeping up with others either, is it? One of the main barriers of financial freedom I've found is the tendency to want to keep up with the Joneses. We start earning a bit more money, so we move into a higher wealth echelon. We get nicer cars, we get fancier appliances. In the old days, you'd go on fancier holidays. That's hard to do at the moment, isn't it? But we keep up with wealthy friends, and that's expensive. And many people don't stop to ask themselves, do they even need the latest new iPhone or the latest car? They're just doing it because everyone else is doing it, and that gets expensive. Success isn't about winning. If you're striving for something just to prove a point to somebody else, then you're not really chasing your own success story. Forget about equating success with beating the opposition. It's about your own measure of achievement. So what is success? Well, we've all got our own ideas of success, but here's my version. I think success is the freedom to shape your own life. I think this is the number one reason many of our clients at Metropole want to achieve success. It's not the money that matters so much, but the freedom that the money gives, the choices. It means they could work less if they want to, while others it means traveling more. It could mean freedom and time to learn new skills or provide a more comfortable retirement or give back to the community. In my mind, success is reaching your potential. I'm a big believer that we've all got the gift that gives us the chance to do something extraordinary with our lives. We all have that ability. It could be starting a business. It could be helping others. It could be leaving a legacy. But whatever it is, there's no mistaking the feeling of work that satisfies the deep need in you. That's success, following your own track. Sometimes in order to achieve that, you need to go down rabbit holes that others wouldn't go down or follow a gut feeling that makes no sense to friends or family. Success is the courage to listen to those instincts and follow your own path, to overcome adversity. Often we don't give ourselves credit for how far we've come and the hurdles we've jumped over. You may not have achieved all your goals yet. Let's be honest, who has? But overcoming adversity or surviving tough situations, surviving 2020, hey, that's definitely a measure of success. Your relationship with others is a good measure of your success. There's no point in amassing a fortune if you step on so many people along the way that you haven't got friends or family left talking to you. In my mind, good relationships with your family, your spouse, your clients all stem from the same ability, that is to maintain healthy relationships. It's what psychologists call high EQ, not IQ, but emotional quotient. It's that underrated trait. Success also is investing in the future. Successful don't just spend their money, they invest it. They reinvest it. They realize that to spend money on assets that appreciate, such as expensive cars, rather than things that appreciate, such as residential property, that's self-defeating. Success is about planning for your future. So to summarize, success isn't about how much money you've got in the bank. I know that's a cliche, but it's a good one. It's not to say that money isn't important. It is. Money is important in those areas of life where it's important, and it's not at all important in other areas of your life. Now, sure, any problem that money can solve isn't a problem, so money is important. But the point I'm trying to make is use the money to give you the freedom that you want in life rather than as a status symbol. Then you'll be successful. Well, we covered a lot in today's show. I taught you some learning fees that you should avoid paying so you've got more money left to invest. Simon Kirstmacher and I discussed some urban trends that are going to be important if you want to become a successful property investor. And in my mindset message, I mentioned a bit about success to you. And if you got some benefit from this, I'd really appreciate it if you helped somebody else, because my aim is to help as many people as possible become financially fluent, become financially independent. So share the information in this show through either using the share button or tell somebody about the Michael Yardney podcast. Of course, you can always tell the world by leaving a review on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you listen to this, Spotify. And if I read it out, as I'm about to read one out at the moment, and you email me michael@metropole.com.au, I'd love to gift you one of my books by way of saying thank you. So Harlequin72 just recently left a review saying, "Great ways to start the week. Thank you, Michael, for your regular podcast. Tuesdays and Thursdays are my favourite day of the week because of your podcast." Well, thank you. It's one of my favourite parts of the week when I record these podcasts. But you can catch up in between these twice-a-week podcasts on social media. Just look for Michael Yardney. And there's also a new private Facebook group where I regularly put information every day where you can get some exclusive information. Have a look for the Property Update Facebook group on Facebook. Ask to join and we'd love to have you as part of the community. I'll be back again twice a week. In the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney Podcast, which was brought to you by Metropole, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney Podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropole to help you?